can hear me with my, I don't know what I sound like, voice. So, but Corky and class, thank you for letting me come today. I don't want to block the visuals. They're going to be an important part of the presentation. I just want to say, first of all, how much, you know, we're still have not joined Trinity, but it's such a blessing to be here. And my family just want to express how much they love the church and the teaching and your fellowship and friendship in the Lord has just meant so much to us. And thank you. Thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to present to you today. This is actually a topic that's very close to my heart about architecture and how architecture is God's creation. Sometimes I think that we forget, at least I do, you know, I tend to forget that, you know, God has made all things. And I think that this presentation today will definitely underscore that even more so. I sincerely hope that it will. Just a little background, and I'm going to mark my time so I don't talk over. I was brought up, when I was studying architecture at Auburn, we always referred to the orders of architecture as Greek. You know, there always seemed to be Greek or Roman, Greco-Roman. And you know, it's sort of like, I think most things, because of the way that things get conventionalized, they can attain a certain nomenclature and people just don't question. You know, many things that God has instituted in our earth and world and universe have been co-opted, you know, by other names. So I don't think that even what you're going to learn today will reverse that, but it is interesting to see who is the author and chief architect, if I may. The first slide, this is one of my favorite types of works of architecture. This is a Beaux-Arts type rendering of a high school in Scotland. I'm sorry I didn't get the name of the person who did it, but you know, you can see the beauty even in this slide, you know, the beauty of the orders of architecture. And when we talk about the orders of architecture, we're talking about the three orders, Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian. Let me pause here for this comment by Leon Battista Alberti. Beauty is that reasoned harmony of all the parts within a body, so that nothing may be added, taken away, or altered but for the worse. It is a great and holy matter. All our resources of skill and ingenuity will be taxed in achieving it, and rarely is it granted, even to nature herself, to produce anything that is entirely complete and perfect in every respect. I think that's a great quote. You know, in a way, we can look at this, especially the second paragraph. I would not want to stake my sanctification on that, on the second one. But if you will, it is like reaching for the stars, you know, in the work that we do, advancing, trying to become better. And I am so thankful that our sanctification isn't based on that. But because of what Christ has done, you know, we can, in His grace, we can improve. This is just a side note to the text here. But I think that the first part of this quote, to me, just resonates. You know, that's a good definition of beauty. And I wanted to just for the sake of discussion, just identify, this is, these are the orders that everyone knows, Doric, Ionic, Corinthian. When it comes to Greece and Rome, Greek is always better. The Romans were copyists. The Greeks seem to emulate the right types of nuances and details to make something beautiful. And my sense of the Romans is that unless they were working with concrete, you know, they just like to copy everything pretty much and put their Roman stamp on it. No, no pun intended. Okay, the standard of architecture from these orders, the Parthenon in Athens, which is composed of the Doric order. What I'm going to present to you in just a minute, I hope you'll keep an open mind to it, because I think it really is, to me, a very plausible proposal. But always, as I've said, we had always learned architecture as being essentially Greek in origin, and then, you know, carried by the Romans to the far-flung marches and to us. Can you see if I stand here, Mr. Mack? Can you see? Okay. Okay, a quote by Vitruvius, the 10 books on architecture from book 2. Architecture depends on order, arrangement, eurythmy, symmetry, propriety, and economy. This is very close to the idea of beauty, of achieving beauty. And when we speak of eurythmy, that had, in his day, had a more of a musical connotation, because architecture and music, even today, I mean, architecture and music are so close. They practically are exact. So if you understand music, there's a very good chance that you understand architecture as well. It's a very, very, very closely allied art, or I should say arts. I need to give you this information also. The reason that the Greeks made beautiful architecture was because, looking at the slide on the left, they understood the need to create optical corrections. You probably have seen some of this on the History Channel. From time to time, they'll run different episodes, and they'll show how the columns have in it's pronounced both ways, in entasis or entasis, where the column, you know, becomes a little more pronounced in the middle. It's a very, very, very highly skilled method of making something look proportional. And the same for the way that columns can appear in a temple front. You know, you have to make corrections. All this is just so amazing, but I could spend a whole whole day lecturing just on this subject alone. And here we can see kind of the essence of what architecture is all about in the aspect of the classical language of architecture. It's all about proportion. It's all about beauty. It's all about creating something lasting, something which is beautiful that the people can really use and enjoy. Even per se for temples, you know, back in the day, this, you know, pagan application, but nonetheless, still beautiful. There's still standards. Now, I'd like to introduce you to the architect who has made a very, very, I think, plausible and excellent argument for the origin of these orders, that they're not from Greece and Rome, but they are, in fact, from the early tabernacle in the wilderness. His name is Quinlan Terry. He's a HRH Prince Charles's favorite architect. Here's a quote from Quinlan Terry. "There is to me only one satisfactory explanation of the origin, and that is that they are divinely inspired."
Somebody shut Siri up.
These are examples of his drawings. He did an essay 30 years ago called Origins of the Orders. I have given a copy to Chris here at the church, so that they can probably get you a copy from those that I gave to Chris. But if you look at the images here and see, it really makes more sense that these orders, which were based on the pattern that was given to Moses in the mount. I mean, you know, God told Moses, be sure to be careful to do all things according to the pattern that I showed to thee in the mount. That's in the text. And so it's a very, very specific language that was handed down. Quinlan Terry is by now the foremost author in expert on these things, but for myself, I've been very interested. I personally held this belief that they must have come from the tabernacle, but it was not until I read Quinlan Terry's article that it gave me hope and encouragement that other people felt this way as well. And but I wanted to stop here just for a second and ask, can you see the connections and see how the outer court examples, the upper two on the very top row, you know, just makes sense? And then when you look down in the middle column, the lower two in the middle column, and then the ones over on the right, as you know, the outer court, inner court, and the Holy of Holies, it just makes more sense to think of the orders, you know, supporting this kind of arrangement in the early tabernacle. Does anyone have any thoughts, feedback, comments? Of course, here's a depiction of the early tabernacle. Most of these depictions are conjectural, but this one seemed to come a little closer because the columns in the perimeter of the outer court really seem to be more on the Doric or simple version of the columns. Somehow this is a plausible idea of the tabernacle to me. Of all the ones I've seen, you know, sometimes when you get with when you begin looking at what different architects have proposed through like the Renaissance, you know, sometimes the people in the rendering will look like they belong to the era of the Renaissance. You know, they really are in the wilderness. It just happens. Now, this is also a very interesting proposal by J.B. Fisher von Erlach, who is a 17th century architect. He lived in the late 17th, early 18th century. And, you know, it seems a little bit over the top, maybe with the height of what they call the pinnacle of the temple, but I prefer his version to the one, even to the model that's in Jerusalem at this time. Somehow when I looked at some of the other examples of the temple, that are, even in biblical commentary books, you know, they look too Chaldean to me. I just hope you don't mind me saying. And this one looks, if you look at, see where he's placed the Holy of Holies in the holy place, it's a little elevated. It makes more sense with having cornices and an attic instead of this flat.
So keep going.
Yeah.
Didn't they find the footings for that just this year? Think they found the actual foundation of that temple this year? Maybe they can figure
out. I'm interested to know.
Because I remember seeing something somewhere back earlier in the year that they think they found the footings to it, or at least some of the structure to it, and they're trying to, you know, you've got piles and piles and piles of architecture in that part of the country. They're just trying to figure out what's going on right now, but they think they found some of the footings to it.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that, because I always tell my students, you know, I can't know everything, and so when someone shares something like this, I'm very appreciative. And,
I'll double check that, but don't. I was just scooped in one of them.
Right. You got me interested now. I'm going to be at work looking at it. That's great. Okay, the important key in understanding how the orders came from Jerusalem to us ultimately was primarily through Alexander. And the argument that Quinlan Terry makes is that Alexander's conquest in kind of, you know, expanding the world, you know, the Occidental world at that time, was very key, and especially with the connection to the library at Alexandria, which, you know, was like the great repository of knowledge at the time in that region. So when you begin to look at this, and, you know, it makes sense, and the timelines fit very well. The next part of this presentation, I'm going to refer to one of my favorite books. In fact, it's really the my favorite book on architectural history. It's called A History of Architecture by Sir Banister Fletcher, and there's his picture. I just wanted, you know, I always used to wonder what he looked like when I was studying the book. You know how you read a book and you wonder what does the author look like? And he looks like Sir Banister Fletcher.
He does.
And I know I'm not him, so British Reserve. And the great, great scholar and author. And in fact, I brought a copy of that book of Sir Banister's. It's about that thick. And there's no way that you can know the book is that thick.
Is it considered to be sort of the standard?
The standard. It absolutely, Bruce. It's and I have I'm just gonna go ahead and pull this book and also I have a copy of the Orders of Architecture, the Origins. This is the article, Origins of the Orders, by Quinlan Terry. And Chris has a copy. So if you'd like a copy, I'll be glad to leave this copy. And if you wanted to find some way to make several copies of this, I think you're welcome to. And then this is Sir Banister Fletcher's book. This is an older copy. But as I tell my students, there's just no way that I think Art Garfunkel would have a hard time. You know, Art Garfunkel had supposedly read thousands of books. I think he would struggle with this. So, but I'll put this here if you want to peruse it. Getting to the subject of the Christian church and with the advent of Christianity, I say that we know it's when the gospel came to us, when Christ came to us. But if I could put it in an academic statement, when the advent of Christianity, of course, changed Rome. Totally changed it's changed the whole world. And as we know, Christians were persecuted very heavily, but in time, as Christianity became more of, I don't want to say the state religion, ultimately it did under Constantine, but as it gained acceptance and, you know, people began, there was the start of a Christian culture. You know, the Roman world began to look more like this because Christians were taking pieces and parts from ancient Rome and even buildings in the provinces and building new churches. This is the Basilica of Maxentius. The reason I show this particular slide is because at a certain point, Christians began meeting initially in the old basilicas. And these were the old justice halls, kind of like courthouses of the Roman period. This is a cork you will like me for saying this, exploded axonometric. Exploded axonometric view of the Roman basilica. You know, when you look at this, I'm going to clip through these quickly so I can get through with the lesson in the right time. But try to see if you can hold some of these images in your head, and especially the plan. I want to show you the plan. This is the plan of the Basilica of Maxentius. Now I want to show you immediately. Remember, Christians started meeting here first when they were in, you know, leftover basilicas. Look at the plan of St. Peter's. This is old St. Peter's, not the present one. Do you see the similarity, especially? Let's see if I can put my finger like on the very end. If I go back. Do you see the basic form has been retained? This was in the better days of St. Peter's also, even theologically. So, and you know, I used to struggle when I would see these because I would think, oh, and I'm trying, someone's trying to convert me to be a Catholic by showing me the Basilica. But that's not it at all. It's an important part of our Christian heritage. As was these examples, St. Apollinaire in Ravenna, built by Theodoric in the 6th century. Beautiful buildings. Now, let me show you the connection here. How we got to where we are today, primarily with Gothic. Post-Roman Empire, there was the early Christian period of architecture. There was the Byzantine era and the Romanesque era or period. Sir Bannister has an interesting statement. Can everybody still hear me? Sir Bannister has a very interesting statement. He says that in many cases, or a number of cases, it is very difficult to tell whether a church is early Christian or Byzantine, or Romanesque. Now, these three are so important. They're kind of like the transition era before Gothic. And I'll show you what the first Gothic church was here in just a moment. But keep this in mind as we look at these slides. All right, here we have Byzantine. That came from Constantinople, the East, the Rome of the East, of the Bosphorus, and so forth. Constantine just really wanted to have everything centered right there in his own city, Constantinople. The key element of Byzantine, if I was given a test question, it'd be very easy. It's just one thing. It's the dome. And the Eastern Dome, I think the Eastern Domes to me are more beautiful in many ways than some of the Western Domes. I'll stop on that. So I can get off on a rabbit trail. And he, you know, this was originally built as a Christian church. Later became a mosque. So the minarets were not there. This is, if you look at the pure core building itself, you know, this is purely, I would like to say, early Christian plus, you know, some Romanesque elements, maybe a little slightly. But it really is, you know, its own style, Byzantine, from the East. And here's the interior, once again. The Hagia Sophia, which means holy wisdom. Justinian was the builder. I say the builder, he was the sponsor. Made it happen. Legend says that when it was completed, he ran into the building or walked into the building. I don't know which was the true case. And he looked up and he said, "Solomon, I have outdone you." This is the Byzantine system of construction. It deals with pendentives, the pendentive dome construction system, arches. All of this knowledge, I should say a greater portion of this knowledge came from the East. And I want to say, Islamic, you might not think that. But the pointed arches that came for Gothic came from Islamic. Remember, you know, the Muslims were around and they were building. Fantastic mathematicians and builders. And so we have these influences in the Christian church at this time. Now this is just a bigger diagram showing how the dome fits on top of the edifice. This is from Sir Bannister's book. And here's some examples. This is considered Byzantine. This is in the province of Aquitania. This is called Saint-Franc in Perigeux, done in the 12th century. This is also in the province of Aquitania. This is Angoulême Cathedral. Now, let me pause here just for a second. What, I didn't put a style on it, but do you see a predominant style or styles? Can you tell if this is early Christian, Byzantine, Romanesque? Let me give you a clue about Romanesque. When you see lots of arches that look Roman, that's Romanesque. And initially it wasn't a compliment. It was kind of like the people of that period said this is Romanesque, means it was sort of like a degrading remark about the building, and it just stuck and became Romanesque. Does anyone want to try? Don't feel bad if you don't guess. If you don't guess it right, it's okay.
Well, it's got a dome in. It's got a lot of arches.
Good. Good start. Good start. Sometimes it. This is why I love Sir Bannister's outlook on this. Because sometimes you really can't tell. It's very hard to tell. Let me go on to the next one. I think this is 50-50 Romanesque. This is Professor talking. Byzantine. Now, what about this one? Oops. I put the label in.
I think it's French Romanesque.
I think it's French Romanesque. Did you know, I was up last night trying to make sure I didn't leave one of these in, and I did. So. I'm glad that when you get to be a teacher, you make so many mistakes. After a while, you just go, shoot me, you know. So, but let's see. Well, let's go to another slide. It's the same cathedral. But does anyone want to take a guess at what the predominant... Now, you know what? I will tell you this. On the previous slide, I gave a test with some of those in it, and I said, don't pay attention to the French Romanesque. I did say that. So, but it is in France, and it does have Romanesque in it. But you can see here's some Gothic, you know, Gothic architecture. Does anybody get a sense of layering, like this church? Has been built in some layers of history.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's the beautiful thing about architecture and studying it. You can see the layers and what the people have done. I gave a test question recently on this, and it was just one sentence. I said something like the blank tower of blank. And, you know, sometimes I just want to help the students out, give them a few points. And I just don't remember if anyone missed that, but I think if they had, I would have to go back and rethink my teaching methods. But this is Italian Romanesque. You know, still has the arches, Roman arches. You can see the Romanism in it, but a little different expression still. But here we have... German Romanesque, which I think most people associate with German Romanesque as being Romanesque more than the Italian. And this is the site of Luther's famous Here I Stand speech as well, pronounced Worms. I want to say Worms, and I feel funny saying it, but I read last night Worms. So the Diet of Worms, that's where he said Here I Stand. Okay, this is the first Gothic church, and you know, in the news, sadly and tragically, with the killings in Paris, the killers were from this part of Paris, Saint-Denis. In Saint-Denis, this church, done by Abbot Suger, who's up in the upper left, this was the first Gothic church done in Europe. Everyone, all the scholars generally agree that this was the first Gothic church, where you saw the clear-cut idea of Gothic and, you know, taller windows to let in light. The diagram of the plan I could elaborate on some more, but just for the sake of time, I'll go ahead and skip it this time. His influences were the Temple of Solomon, writings which were incorrectly attributed to Saint Denis, and the Hagia Sophia. So he was influenced, Abbot Suger, by the Hagia Sophia. And that's the version of the Temple of Solomon that I said looked Chaldean. Just doesn't. I put it in here because it was the only one I could find. Medieval construction, the practices, they weren't called architects at this time. They were called master builders. The term architect, let me take issue with this a little bit. People were using the term architect, but think history records that here it was master builder was more common. For some reason, it was just more common. So much based on geometry. And to give you, you know, the proportions of the Gothic style, Gothic building, which you can see here. Examples that we're familiar with, Notre Dame in Paris, 12th century, done by master builders. Now, can you see with the plan, think back on the Roman Basilica and see how this has evolved. You see how things have progressed, early Christian, Byzantine, Romanesque, now to Gothic. It's kind of a clearly delineated style. But you can still see, you know, if you squint your eyes, you can still see the relationship to the early basilica here. Now, here's a test question. You didn't know I was going to give you a test. Tell me what you see in this this frame of the elevation that stands out. I have to ask you to look very closely.
You've got some progressive arches right in there that scale that's set back down.
12 apostles and 12 tribes of Israel.
Yeah, I do see the apostles.
Let me reframe the question too. Yes, good answers. Very good. Is this a symmetrical and balanced?
It's asymmetrical. No. It's asymmetrical. It sure is.
Does it look? Are all the arches or the bays the same?
No. The door
sizes. And door sizes, right? Do you see the detail here?
Yeah.
Which is different. You know, from usually it would be center, left and right, they're equal. You can draw a center line and the left side mirrors the right side. But did everybody see this? The disparity? This is common on cathedrals. Cathedral building, they would, I don't know if it was because maybe Grandfather Monmart over on this side, you know, started that section of the cathedral and then he died and then later on, the grandchildren took over, and they decided they didn't want to put a pediment, a slight pediment.
Maybe the masons didn't want to put it there.
Even the doorways, three different sized doorways.
That's right. That's right. And someone, I think, I got my shadow on this. This part on the right side is smaller. Let's see. Here's another. What do you see?
You talked about different fathers. Does this mean that the architect, master builder, or grandfather, father, son, and the mindset?
Exactly.
In the family.
In the family.
That's where the term grandfather came from.
One side's narrow.
That's right. Generational. The dates on these, sometimes some of these cathedrals took 800 years to build.
Notre Dame, something like that. 1600?
Right. Sometimes a cathedral could be built in 30 years if they had a lot of money and a lot of labor. did anyone see anything here? Describe anything
smaller.
Right side is smaller? Yeah. Exactly. You know, these are things I didn't know until I started teaching. And, because you have to be prepared and these small details come out when you do more research. Chartres, we all know and love Chartres. It's a great example. 12th century. Great rose window and stained glass. This one, Beauvais, has an interesting story. It's still a success story, but it was built very, very high and it collapsed. And then they rebuilt it. And at one time, it had a crossing tower over the where the two gables cross. And it was so heavy, they had to take it off. It was like 500 feet high, I think. If you can imagine a tower that's 500 feet high.
And it's not cement. This is just the weight of the stones, right?
Right. Right, combination.
All the way up.
That's right. It had stone cladding. Some, wood framing at some point. But it became a hazard, so they took it down. But I mean, 500 feet, you know, this diagram, if you can read it, I won't go up and show, but if you look at the side on the left, that's what it should have been, and it never was built, so they closed it off at what they call the transepts, which is what you see here. So it's kind of a unique model, but this is the present nave, and tremendously high, and a good success story, but they had lots of struggles with this cathedral. Sainte-Chapelle, which is called the Jewel Box, it's an example of the Rayonnette style. This is the interior. Extremely beautiful, beautifully detailed stained glass, and gold leaf, and we're getting close to the end now. You see this great traditional building before these slides. We get down into the 19th and 20th and now 21st centuries in America, and the thing that made our country and Europe sustained such a great tradition was the École des Beaux-Arts School, which was in Paris. And they did work just like this on the cover of this book, which I'm going to recommend at the end of the talk. The Beaux-Arts system of building was like the best of Greek and Roman learning, the best of Gothic, Gothic proportions. architecture is art. The ability to draw and present your ideas just like this by hand. And so this was our tradition until around World War II, when the modern school began to rise. But the result of the École des Beaux-Arts tradition produced things like St. Patrick's Cathedral here in New York, which is designed by James Renwick, who did the Smithsonian Institution at 28 years old. Can you believe that? And his office produced other people like Bertram Goodhue of the firm Cram, Goodhue, and Ferguson, who did commissions like this for the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, which was proposed to be French Gothic. Like I said, I'm trying to keep this all very, very short for the time, but you see, this is speaking on the issue of beauty. You know, I think most people would agree these are beautiful buildings. The tradition of building that's speculated to be several thousands of years old, 5,000 to 6,000 years old, the buildings are beautiful. They're beautiful because they have a system, they have an order, they have proportion and harmony, and the people who did this and carried this tradition into our time understood these things. I think that's what Dr. Sproul was trying to get at in his talk. He was saying, you know, if you don't care about architecture and you don't try to strive to find what beauty is, you know, you're going to lose it. And ultimately, you're going to lose it in the culture. And I'll close with these are quotes by John Ruskin. There is no wealth but life. When love and skill work together, expect a masterpiece. Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of intelligent effort. When we build, let us think that we build forever. Now, to me, that's beautiful. I just can't improve on. The second and third one really speak to me, I think, the loudest out of all of these. I agree with the other two. And I think that's where Dr. Sproul was going in his talk. I kind of sense that. You know, how can we do this, you know, from where we are today? I was talking with Corky yesterday, and I think that, you know, we can have an attitude of you know, being understanding of people who don't have access or know of people like Ruskin, but they do the best that they can. Early builders in Alabama, for instance, built log cabins, and then they built a second log cabin and put a roof over both. And then when they got wealthier and more skilled, they built
the second,
exactly. And you know, there was a beauty to each part of that building phase. I think if we have that kind of attitude, I think we'll do well as a church, you know, as Christ ambassadors. But I do think that somehow I get the feeling everyone knows or has some concept of beauty inside them. And I think that maybe we as Christians can help them, maybe take them even by the hand and help them to understand what beauty is, and to think of higher virtues. And you know, this would be in keeping with our faith, but also at the same time, we can always learn ourselves, and just like from people like Ruskin. As I said earlier, I tell my students, I'm a lifelong student, so I'm always learning. But I close with these. I think these are great to close on, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and I apologize if I think I did go over.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. I'll